On this week's 51%, school districts draft transgender policies.
As a gay woman who 30 years ago, if I talked about being a lesbian, there would be the same kind of issues and fright that's going on right now about transgender kids.
We take a look at women's roles in the Navy. One of the first female pilot cadets in Israel talks about her travel venture, and we have a listener essay on body image. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Some people flee, some see the enemy. Some people find a solace in their ideology. Some people see a world encumbered by diversity. Yeah. I'm not the thorn in your side. I'm not the break in your heart. I'm not the speck in your eye. I'm not the falling apart. I'm not your flow.
School districts are working to draft transgender policies to protect a student's rights. The transgender issue affects not only students in K through 12, but at colleges and universities. WBFO's senior reporter Eileen Buckley says there is no one set policy in place for schools to follow after President Obama's recent directive.
President Obama issued a directive to public schools across the U.S. saying transgender students should use a bathroom or locker room in which they identify with.
I think some districts are absolutely struggling with this situation. They want to make sure that individuals, students are 100% protected from any type of discrimination, while at the same time balancing the concerns that some individuals in their community have with regard to just these differences.
Tracy Lepardi is an attorney at Harris Beach in Buffalo. She specializes in education law. The debate continues over transgender students' rights in a school. Lepardi says the Obama directive was issued in a joint letter from the Department of Justice and Department of Education.
And that guidance, while it doesn't have the same force of law, that certainly is something that various educational institutions need to consider, because otherwise they could potentially lose federal funding. We've seen some lawsuits around the country, but certainly the Department of Justice becoming involved with various schools and telling them that they must provide appropriate facilities to transgender individuals, otherwise they will lose federal funding.
But almost a year ago here in New York, the State Education Department did issue a transgender and gender nonconforming students guidance document to assist districts with their policies.
So this is very personal for me. As a gay woman who 30 years ago, if I talked about being a lesbian, there would be the same kind of issues and fright that's going on right now about transgender kids.
Randy Weingarten is president of the American Federation of Teachers. Weingarten says it is about the safety and security of transgender students.
They have to be safe emotionally, they have to be safe physically, and that the places where we've had bathrooms that accommodate non-conforming gender issues or accommodate kids who are transgendered, there's not been any safety issues there. That's actually been better for everyone involved.
Weingartner says she was recently involved in an op-ed piece in Delaware where they've changed the policy to make sure transgender students are comfortable in locker rooms and bathrooms.
It's actually been helpful. It's actually been less, there's been fewer issues, not more issues. And I think those policies are good. Those policies are important in terms of inclusiveness, but most important, those policies are important in terms of safety and security of children.
But those who oppose a transgender person using a locker room or bathroom of their choice believe that there could be potential danger for other students. For students in kindergarten through 12th grade, they are protected in New York State under the Dignity for All Students Act. That's designed to provide a safe and supportive environment without discrimination or bullying. Colleges and universities follow federal guidelines.
I think one of the other difficulties, too, is that school districts also have to maintain the privacy for students under the Federal Family Rights and Privacy Act. In that regard, these types of decisions and these types of circumstances pertaining to students are, and they should be, very much on a case-by-case basis.
Back in January, the Clarence School District approved a policy, but before the vote, both parents and students spoke out for and against the issue. The Buffalo Public School District is calling the president's directive welcome news. The district is working on developing its own policy to enhance protections and support students. Lepardi says while districts must remain cognizant of the law and interpretations, The most important aspect is to make sure adults are listening to students. Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
And now we hear from a U.S. senator from New York on Hillary Clinton's essentially having clinched the Democratic nomination for president. Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who in 2009 was appointed to the Senate seat vacated by Clinton, who became Secretary of State, is a strong Clinton supporter. Gillibrand addresses potential picks for a vice presidential running mate, giving a nod to U.S. Senator from Massachusetts Elizabeth Warren.
Well, I do think it is a historic moment. I am so grateful for this nation for nominating Hillary Clinton to be the first female nominated candidate for a national party. It's really exciting. And I know that Secretary Clinton will pick the most qualified person, the person who she believes can stand next to her in governing this nation. I think all the people suggested so far, they're terrific, and I fully support a two-female ticket. I think that would be also historic. So I just welcome the rest of this campaign. I think Hillary Clinton has shown that she is the most qualified person running for president and that she would be the best commander-in-chief.
This country's ready for a two-woman ticket?
Absolutely. Of course we are.
That was Hillary Clinton supporter and U.S. Senator from New York, Kirsten Gillibrand. Some members of Congress are criticizing recent Pentagon decisions that allowed women into the infantry, a combat job previously restricted to men. Critics say it will make the military less effective. But in the Navy, women have been serving on warships for 20 years, and now it's not unusual for women to command them. John Ismay reports from Naval Station San Diego.
It's deployment day for the 320 sailors aboard the guided missile destroyer USS Decatur. It's a billion-dollar warship loaded with Tomahawk missiles and guns. And up in the pilot house is something you'd never have seen when the Navy ordered the ship back in the early 90s. Three women leading the way.
Forward deck made up. Got it.
Aft is already made up, right?
Yeah. Lieutenant Laura Baumgartner is the officer of the deck. Together with Lieutenant Anna Douglas, they're running the checklist to get underway. And they're both reporting to Commander Mary Katie Hayes, the ship's executive officer. One of the lieutenants coaches the sailors handling the rudder and engine controls.
Slow is smooth, smooth is fast.
In case you missed that, she said slow is smooth and smooth is fast. Good advice for driving the ship, and also not a bad way of looking at how women have made strides in the surface Navy. Women weren't allowed to serve on a warship like Decatur until 1994. To Commander Hayes, who was commissioned in 99, all of this is routine.
How's the morning going so far?
It's been busy, but it's been awesome. Getting the ship underway for deployment, this is what we've been training to do.
This destroyer, with a team of women taking the lead, that's a very different Navy than retired Captain Bobby Scully joined in 1981.
It's just incredible the differences that women were allowed to do from the time I came in the Navy in 1981 until I retired in 2005.
In 81, women were only allowed on support ships. By 1983, the Navy began to open up more programs, and Scully became one of the first women to graduate from the rigorous deep-sea dive school. Nowadays, Scully hears critics say that units that include women can't fight as effectively as all-male ones. She says that's the same kind of claim women in her generation proved wrong.
I just have to chuckle that these arguments didn't hold any water back then, and I'm pretty sure they're not going to hold any argument today.
Back on the USS Decatur, Garrett Miller is the commanding officer for this deployment. And soon after the ship gets back to San Diego, he'll turn over the captain's chair to Mary Katie Hayes. Both Miller and Hayes came to the ship as second in command, and then in Navy terms, fleeted up to be the commanding officer.
I think she's going to be a phenomenal captain. When you've got two commanders on the same ship that are working towards the same goal, you know, there's nothing you can't do.
One person who's seen Decatur change through the years is Joan Shalikashvili, whose late husband was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the mid-1990s. She's the ship's sponsor, meaning she's the one who broke the bottle of champagne over the bow when Decatur was christened and has followed the ship closely ever since.
This will be our third female commander. And I don't even think twice about it. I think they don't think twice about it now. I know they did years ago.
Commander Hayes didn't think twice about it either. She didn't start out wanting to command a destroyer, but instead, from day one of her career, she found herself
looking at the job that my bosses did and asking myself, you know, do you think you're capable of that job? Do you think you'd like to do that job? And the answer has been yes.
And for more and more service members just starting out these days, they'll have strong female role models like Commander Hayes to look up to. Author Gail Samaklamon, who studied the issue of women in combat, says that's important.
I think both men and women can be incredible mentors and leaders. But certainly when somebody looks like you, it's one step closer to imagining yourself in that role.
With the last combat exclusions lifted, those first female infantry officers are blazing a new trail for women in the Army and Marine Corps. Just as the women of Bobby Scully's generation made it possible for officers like Mary Katie Hayes to take combat command in the Navy.
One Alpha 2 Bravo, G-Chan's online, standing by to transfer to
Overdrive. I'm John Ismay reporting.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Navy song Anchors Away contains the lyrics, "Anchors away, my boys, anchors away." This week, we bring you another installment of the 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California, and she blogs for the Huffington Post. This week, she interviews Mikhail Alter, who founded Visit.org in 2014 as an online marketplace for tours and activities that benefit communities. Visitors add immersive local experiences to their existing travel itineraries, and social organizations raise awareness and revenue for their causes. Alter is one of the first female pilot cadets in the Israeli Air Force and a computer science engineer, and was the director of refugee affairs at the city government in Tel Aviv prior to her move to New York City. Ufberg inquires how Visit.org differs from the several other travel sites out there.
So Visit.org is unique because all of our suppliers are unique, exclusive suppliers that you basically cannot find online today. And the reason for that is that all of our suppliers are local community-based organizations and nonprofits, or really any type of organization that their day-to-day job is to benefit their local community. So what we do is we go to these organizations that have a great track record of positive impact on their communities. We help them create an experience that is attractive and safe for travelers, and also very immersive and authentic because of the nature of these organizations. They are able to offer experiences that are just truly the reality of people's life in the place. And then we help them package it. And a lot of times it's a half-day experience or a couple-of-day-long experience. We help them price it. We help them decide on different factors such as what kind of travelers they want to accept, how many, what's the capacity, how frequently can they receive visitors. And then we create a beautiful content page for them on our centralized marketplace. So all of our providers are ones that you cannot find anywhere else. And in terms of the traveler browsing through these experiences and booking on our platform, booking these experiences and paying for them, there is really no place else online where you can find these kind of travel experiences today. The cherry on top for all of the experiences that are booked on Visit.org is that all revenue is always invested back into the local community. So by the nature of our partner organizations, of our suppliers, because they are nonprofits or social organizations, all of their revenue that they make from these tours, they always invested back into their regular programs that benefit their local environment, their local social structure, their economic development, animal preservation, you know, youth empowerment, women empowerment, whatever it is that they are working towards to enhance. And then for the traveler can do something that is fun, immersive, but also impactful.
How did you come up with this idea?
Well, my background is in computer science, and I worked in technology for several years, and at some point started volunteering with a local organization in my neighborhood that worked with the refugee community from Darfur and South Sudan and Eritrea. And when I started volunteering with this organization, I saw that this organization had so many assets, such as a truly trust relationship with the members of their local community, as well as a unique understanding of their history and culture, and so many beautiful assets that really all of them talk to human interaction. And the what's beautiful about the human interaction and relationships. And I thought, well, these organizations could offer so much to the world if they could just open their doors to a larger audience. So usually these nonprofits work with a group of volunteers, and then there's usually a group of donors that come and visit them maybe once or twice a year. But other people don't get to really come and interact and see the kind of reality on the ground and have these human interactions. Also, as an I traveled a lot. I did a lot of solo travel in the past, and for me, my most memorable experiences have always been about the relationship that I managed to develop with the real people at the destination. But I had the ability and the luxury of traveling for prolonged periods of time, and therefore I was able to develop this kind of relationship and meet people on the ground. So the bottom line for me was, well, why won't we take these two sides? On the one hand, the travelers have today, the demand for local authentic experiences is really on the rise and one of the fastest trends in the travel industry. And on the other side, there are these amazing local organizations that are doing great work and always look for to raise funds and awareness for their cause. Why won't we marry these two together, place them in the travel industry, try to put them more and more into the mainstream travel industry, and really create a win-win situation for both sides?
Can you give us one or two examples of the kinds of experiences that people could find that they could go to? You know, just give us one or two.
Sure. So I just took a tour yesterday here in New York City. Of a local or nonprofit organization in the Lower East Side called Green Map, and they create maps of different of sustainability of the city. So things like bike routes and things like where you can recycle things and anything that has to do with urban sustainability. And I took a tour with them. They are one of our partner organizations that we love. I took a two-hour tour of the Lower East Side, and even though I've been to the Lower East Side many, many times before, because it's just a very popular neighborhood here in the city to go out and hang out in, this two-hour of experience was just eye-opening, and not only eye-opening for me, but really I saw the neighborhood through a complete different lens. All of a sudden, I look differently at local building and how they were created in a sustainable way. So that's one example of New York City, but you can also book experiences on visit.org, other experiences such as making your own coffee with farmers in Guatemala, and revenue will support the local farmer cooperative. You can take your family to spend a day at the Penguin Rehabilitation Center in South Africa, and their revenue will help rehabilitate these cute little penguins. You can spend half a day with a family in Vietnam preparing a traditional meal, or spend 3 days at a local biodiversity research institution in the Amazon in Peru, and then revenue will support and further their research. So it's really, there's a lot of diversity in the type of experiences that we offer and in the length of them. And I always say that I believe that one of the advantages that we have at Visit.org, because we work with the nonprofit sector, the social impact sector, there's really, if you think of it, there's no human area or issue or topic in the world that there is no nonprofit organization that works specifically to enhance that human issue. And that's why we have such a varied supply market and so interesting, so vibrant.
vibrate on any topic of the world. You can find an experience anywhere in the world.
Thank you so much, Michal. This sounds like an incredible enrichment for anyone who's traveling anywhere in the world. Michal Alter, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
You're so welcome. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
And we have a listener essay that comes from Stephanie Trombley of Western New England University.
My body is my best friend. When I was in high school, I was bullied into believing I was the fat girl. My ex-boyfriend dumped me on the grounds that I was just too fat to please him. I was constantly told by the media that I was not the right size to be considered a real woman. But despite what I am told, I know I am a real woman. I am just who I want to be. When I wear crop tops, excess weight peaks through the bottom. When I wear a skirt, my thick thighs are shown to the world, and my stretch marks stand right out. Regardless, my body is my best friend. I wake up each day and eat healthy greens. I turn away from fast food. I get in my exercise. I don't binge on sweet goods or lay around like a couch potato watching reruns of sitcoms all day. But this is not because I want to be thin or change who I am. Because my body is my best friend. People will say, "You can't dress like everyone else." False. I just have to walk a few extra feet to the plus size section at the store, which typically has the exact same clothing that any other girl would wear, but in a size 14 instead of 4. Sometimes I will hear, "You'll never impress a boy that way." I don't need to impress a boy. I need to impress me. And the more I love myself, the easier it will be for someone to love me just as much. These words did get to me at first, but not for long. I just had to remind myself that none of these statements were true. Sizes and numbers on the scale are just numbers. Last time I checked, I am not a number. I am a woman. I am a college student, a radio personality, an author, a daughter, a girlfriend, a sister, an auntie, most of all, a person. I am not a number. My body is my best friend. This body gives me the ability to live and breathe. I still have the ability to run, write, speak, and love. I just have to do it in a size 18. I still have the ability to do anything and everything that an average-sized woman gets to do. I just have large drive and a large dress to accomplish it all in. Maybe bullies at school will tell you that you are fat. Maybe a cruel boy will tell you that you're too large to love. Remember, you are not fat. Your personality is much bigger than any article of clothing in your closet. Your brain is the heaviest body part on you, and you can use it to overcome the stereotypes. I am not the fat girl. I am not the perfect woman for a boy. I am not the media's idea of a supermodel. I am me, and my body is my best friend.
That was Stephanie Trombley of Western New England University. For more on the issue of body image, why not visit show number 1402 online at our archives at WAMC.org, or you can sign up for our podcast and listen to a photographer who takes on societal sneers at body image in her book, The Watchers. And you can also visit the 51% archives on our website or sign up for a podcast to hear this show again. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. And you can follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1405.